Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest is the singer with one of the best and most important bands of all time. And that's not an exaggeration. They're one of those artists whose drive to make something new, to make something extraordinary, changes the musical world around them. Just like Bowie did, like Talking Heads did, like Aphex Twin, or the Velvet Underground, or the Beatles. We're marking both the 20th anniversary of their album, OK Computer, and their Glastonbury headlining set here at the station. So as part of Six Music Celebrates Radiohead, I'm very happy to say my guest on The First Time this week is Thom Yorke. Here in a very rare interview, Thom looks back at his very earliest musical influences, the very start of Radiohead, and how the band work, how they learnt to create albums like The Bends and OK Computer. And we discuss the making of that landmark record and the emotional pressure that Thom experienced during the time. We also talk about the political aspects of his songwriting, especially in connection to their last album, A Moon-Shaped Pool, and the band's future. Plus, we play some amazing music from Can, Aphex Twin and Gil Scott-Heron. But I started by asking Thom the traditional first-time question. The first question we always ask everybody on the programme is the very first time they were aware of music as a kid. Can you remember?
Yes.
What was it?
My grandma Sly bought me, is it Mungo Jerry? In the summertime, Oh man, I still love that song.
And touch the sky when the weather's fine. You got women on your mind. Have a drink, have a drive. Go out and see what you can find.
I saw the video they did. There's chops on the guy. Wow. It's a great tune. It really is a great tune. Everything about it is like, what the hell were these people on?
When the sun goes down, you can make it good and live by.
Is it true that your parents didn't have a hi-fi in the house till you got one?
They still don't. We had some dodgy, like, ITT cassette player, and my dad had a dictaphone for his work, which I nicked and never gave back. That was pretty good, actually, that one. And we had the hi-fi in the Volvo.
What can you remember hearing in the Volvo?
Queen, a lot. Before that, unfortunately, the Volvo before that was an 8-track of Scottish dance tunes. I even listened to that when I was like 6. Not kidding.
What about the first single?
Single. Never did singles. I only started buying singles when I started DJing at college.
Okay, well, the first music that was yours that didn't belong to your parents then?
That was Queen's Greatest Hits on cassette.
Strong
which
out.
I wore out. And then, after that, there was a period of like really dodgy heavy metal bands. You know, some hi-fi, people had those hi-fis where they had a microphone and the only way you could record your mate's records was to stick the microphones in front of the speakers of the other record player and record it. So there's this weird sort of tone to it. Listening to some really, really bad heavy metal like that. Well, actually, the AC/DC album Back in Black was in that lot.
First gig, first live music experience.
Weirdly, not many things come to Oxford, now or then. Joan Armatrading came to the Apollo, and she had a song I really liked at the time when I was a kid. And she was great, actually. Her voice, I still love her voice. Weird choice, but I mean, I really, really enjoyed it just because it was nothing. It wasn't angry, it wasn't anything, but her voice was so incredible.
I am not in love, but I'm open to persuasion. East or west, where's the best for romance? With a friend, I can smile, but with a lover, I could hold my head back and really laugh, really laugh. Thank you. You took me dancing across the floor, cheek to cheek, but with a lover. I could really dance, really dance, really dance. I could really move, really move, really move, really move. Now if I can feel the sun in my eyes and the rain on my face, why can't I? I may need my home, but I should just stick to those that I have got. With friends I still feel so insecure. Little darling, I believe you can help me a lot. Just take my hand and lead me where you will. No conversation, no way goodnight.
Do you remember sort of thinking, I could see myself?
No.
No.
That was much later. I didn't really think that until I saw Susie and the Banshees. They played at the Apollo, and she just broke her leg. That was my favourite gig in Oxford. I met her once and went on and on. And on. Embarrassed myself. But I think, for some reason, I didn't really see that much live stuff when I was a kid. But that one completely blew my mind because she came on and she was in, you know, on this crutch thing. And I'd never seen anyone manage to captivate an audience like she did, you know, with nothing. Just basically with her state of mind. The fact that she was absolutely going to nail it. Didn't matter what happened, she did not care. And it was amazing to watch, you know, watching Budgie. It was an amazing show. And then went seeing New Order a week later, and they slagged everybody off and stormed off. I'm like, okay, that's how not to do it.
What's the Susie track we should play?
Happy House. The anthem of crashing other people's parties and stealing the records and booze and then leaving.
First person you met in terms of who would become Radiohead? I guess he would have been.
I went on this weird recruitment drive in my own head. Yeah, because I'd heard that he joined this band that I'd sort of left, and I felt really sorry for him because he was playing bass, but they only had a really short lead. So it was, you know,
tethered to the amp.
Yeah. So I put him down on the list, and I knew his brother was like this big genius, but younger, and I'd heard there was this really great drummer, a bit older. I was trying to find who it was, and then Ed was just walking around looking like he was in the Smith, so obviously he was going to join.
Standard. What were your first impressions of them all?
I don't really remember. I just remember that it was like, we didn't really need to say much, we just sort of got on with it, really. It was one of my favourite early experiences was doing this four-track demo with Phil in his house around the corner from school, and it was actually good. I mean, I'm still trying to find it. I know it exists, but Lock the Door, it's called. And it was really cool. It had this really cool lo-fi quality about it, and thinking, oh, right, maybe we can actually do this. Maybe, you know.
Were you quite driven at the start?
I certainly drove my parents around the bend. Absolutely drove them crazy. My bedroom was above the TV room, and I had this amp in there, this Misa Boogie amp. And those things are loud even when they're quiet. And they'd try and watch TV every night. And it would just be me trying to track things on a four track or whatever. Just, I don't know how they put up with it. I really don't. Now I have a house with two kids who do the same thing to me all day long, every day.
Dad! God!
No. They're the ones playing the music. And I'm like, listen, can...
What can you remember from the early Radiohead gigs? Can you remember anything from them?
I remember one with a drum machine, which was a bit awkward. That was a bit pants. We did one at the school. That was just excruciating, really embarrassing.
What, like an afternoon gig for school kids?
Yeah, it was terrible. And I do remember, well, it's not really relevant, but I remember the big punk gig that got all the school, got all rock music banned, apparently. There's all these punk bands. When I first joined the school, when I was only 13. I mean, it all sounds ridiculous, we talk about it now, but all these kids from town came and there was fights and someone's got stabbed and those are the seats in this brand new beautiful our new arts theatre, got slashed and all this stuff. And so the headmaster used that as an excuse to ban all contemporary electronically amplified music for the rest of the time I was at school, which is a bit awkward. So it was always a question of trying to work around that.
How did you work around that?
I was very lucky that we were very lucky, especially me, that the head of music was having none of it. So there was an open warfare going on.
Because I've interviewed all the rest of the guys now, and you're all, I can't, it sounds like a very obvious thing to say, you're very, very different.
We're all nutters. But I was always the nutter. And that I've seemed to have infected them all.
Why did it work early on, do you think?
It worked because we supported each other a lot in a kind of a really interesting way. And everyone was coming to it from a different point of view, which was actually really good. Johnny comes to it from the point of view of searching to find the notes you shouldn't use. Always has done. And the sounds you shouldn't use. Colin comes to it from the point of view about arrangement. Phil comes into it about, like, feel, obviously, because he's a drummer. Ed's coming with these extra sounds and stuff. But also outside of that is how we approach everything else, you know. Like, some guys in the band, even before we signed any record deals or anything like that, they'd read all the books. They'd spent a long time reading about where the music business was at.
Really?
Yeah. In a way that was totally uncool. But it was actually really good because at the time, you know, we signed to EMI and everybody slagged us off because it was all about indies. It was all about Creation Records. It was all about... And we'd be saying, yeah, but most of these indies have got licensing deal to major. No one listened to us. And it was like... We were just saying, well, this is just hypocritical because actually you're still working with the man anyway, you know. And things like that actually really helped us in the long run. But at the time, people just thought we were nuts.
First impressions of Nigel.
Oh, God. He was editing, when we did Planet Telex, I think it was, he produced one of those really early little Apple Macs and did, like, all this editing on the drums, whoosh, and then threw it back onto the multi-track without any, like, a blink. And I was like, wow, I've never seen anyone do that before. You know, it was all about momentum and all about, I don't know. And he really just felt like we were contemporaries of each other in a certain way, you know, of peers. We, I think, in the process of doing the bends, when we got to sort of the end of it, we really got obsessed with the whole DIY thing, but doing it in the context of not lo-fi, you know, doing it like Can. And we'd been reading books about how Can recorded and blah blah blah, and, you know, obviously all the usual suspects like the Beatles and so on. We were actually really getting into the techniques, and Nigel was like a library of information on all this stuff. You know, when we went to him and said, do you want to do this with us? We're going to buy all our own equipment and do it. We want to just do it ourselves, independent of everything. It was obvious that he would ask him, because it wasn't even anyone else we were considering.
You mentioned Can. What's the Can track we should play at this juncture?
Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh, my God.
Future days, always.
Okay.
That's how you should start every morning.
OK, Computer, you mentioned this before, this idea of just kind of buying all this gear and doing it. I mean, as much as a record can have an agenda, was that the agenda? Just total freedom and our own space, our own equipment, and just go into it with complete abandon?
Yeah, like a sort of warts and all thing. We were listening to Morricone, we were listening to Can all the time, Faust, general sort of early Kraftwerk, Penderecki, all this stuff on the back of the bus, you know, all the time. And we were kind of fascinated about that warts and all recording thing, like things that are distorted, things that the mics aren't in the right place, or it's all really top-endy, or it's imperfect.
Mm.
Because, you know, we've gone through this interesting process of, like, we signed to a major record company. We were working in a world back then where if you make a record, you go to a studio and we're the last sort of generation, like, to actually, you can only make record in a studio. So you turn up in the studio. It's £1,000 a day, but no pressure, right? It was just like, not sure about this. This doesn't feel right at all, you know, and then gradually realizing, actually, no, you don't have to do it like this. And then realizing the technology you choose to use and how you choose to use it is part of your art and should be in your hands. It should be part of the creative process. And Nigel was absolutely like an enabler for that, saying, yeah, this is all free range. It's free range, you know. So the stuff we were listening to felt like those artists had the same approach, you know.
Mm. Like No Surprises, that was First Take, wasn't it?
Yeah, I heard Johnny say that. I think that's right. All I remember is we argued about how fast it should be, because there was this whole thing, oh, it was me, but we had this whole thing about, it had to sound like we'd all taken Mogadon. Because, and so we tried to play it as slow as we could, but it was never slow enough because we weren't on Mogadon. So what we did was we took an earlier version, we just slowed it right down, and we experimented, slow it down around, you wouldn't know it slowed down unless I told you, but it is. So it has this, because of what I'm singing, you have to have something that's not right about it.
Yeah.
And I do remember, I think the vocal we ended up using was a vocal. The first place we recorded at was like these metal tin sheds where we did rehearsals in this farm, in a sort of derelict bit of the farm, staring at Didcot Power Station outside doing the vocal in the sunshine with Didcot Power Station. It was perfect.
Because, yeah, I mean, if OK Computer is your Sergeant Pepper, kind of live, that's your free bird, I think. It's still, for a really dark as hell tune, it's got that, oh, everyone has this emotional moment.
Which to me is like,
exactly,
you understand the irony, right? But it has been a really weird, like, call to arms is not the right word, but over the last few years when we play in America, it always gets this huge reaction. The bring down the government bit, sometimes you get real shivers because people start yelling. It started happening a few years ago, at the end of when Bush was in power, I think. People just start yelling spontaneously. It's great. I don't know why. It was such a unpunk song would release this kind of weird anger.
Sorry for comparing it to Freebird, you know what I mean.
Yeah, great choice. I was hoping for Anarchy in the UK, but all right.
Full of
This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Tom York.
Six Music. BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
We'll be right back.
was I Promise, a newly released song recorded during Radiohead's sessions for OK Computer in 1997, which features on the new 20th anniversary release of the record. OK Computer famously dealt with vast, complex contemporary themes like technological anxiety, consumerism, political apathy, globalisation, and a loss of individuality, a reflection of Tom's own obsessions and experiences at the time.
A lot of that record seems to be about... It's from the viewpoint of someone looking in rather than someone in it. I don't know. I can put that better.
Yeah, you can.
It's like the best perspective on how society is someone from the outside of society.
Oh, I
and
see.
That seemed to be maybe that's the perspective that you were writing from rather than writing about yourself and your feelings.
It was very much, we were living in orbit, you know, we living on a bus or living in a studio and we barely have taking any time off at all for quite a long time. So whenever you did step back into life in any way at all, it was like, what's this? Can't, does not compute, get it? You know, in a way, a sort of privileged perspective,
yeah,
to just be pulled out of things so much and just totally involved in working on music. That's it, all the time. To the point where it was too much, but it did mean that what I ended up writing about was the fact that I felt very little connection with my fellow human beings. Not much has changed, chaps.
Decision to go back and do the box set as a band that's always looking forward, but it's a pleasurable surprise to sort of see you going back and going, okay, we're going to revisit this.
I really enjoyed maybe it's not quite the right word. It was really interesting. Some of it I really enjoyed. Some of it was absolutely fascinating. The notebooks turned up in the office in a box.
So these are what, studio notebooks?
All my notebooks for that period, which I couldn't work out where they were, and then all the tapes turned up and all the cassettes, and then we dug up all the multi-tracks and blah blah blah. But I guess my particular angle on it was what I found really fascinating was my sort of real, the weird way in was going through my notebooks at the time and just making friends with whoever this nutter was.
Did it feel like that?
Oh my god, I think I'm bad now. Just pages of like, seriously, mate, you need to take a break. but also in the sort of obsessiveness, you'd have these like, wow. I was obsessive about taking notes, about that was the only way to feel that I was making sort of progress. And I'd endlessly do different versions of the lyrics, endless. There's like, you know, 30 or 40 different versions of Paranoid Android.
40 different versions?
Yeah, it, just in different pages, I could endlessly write out. That was when I could see. So the notebooks are really small, and the lettering's really, really small. Slightly different. And you know, I'd only changed like 5 words. It's like, it was like a meditation. I was sitting on a bus going somewhere, you know, and write it out again and again and again. Underlining this, for me, was the sense that, like, I didn't have a real job, but I wanted to, but this was work, and my notebooks at the time were my point of focus, pulling everything together, whether it's ideas about arrangements or just observations or just random drawings or whatever. It was like, I have a job, this is my job, which is nuts, but really it was you know, that's how I sort of dealt with the fact that, like, I was just a bit of guilt involved, you know, like, I'm not really doing anything with my life, but I'm doing this. Anyway, by the time we'd finished the record, we had a meeting about what we're going to do for the shows and stuff, and I was like, I can't do Glastonbury. I can't do it.
Really?
No, I can't do it. I burnt myself out making the record, and the idea of having to put myself back, you know, it was a weird time for me. I'd got really obsessed, and it was sort of a little bit of, I just needed a break, and then, in fact, didn't get one for another year and a bit, by which point I was pretty much catatonic.
But, you know, come back with Glastonbury, nice no-stress gig, nothing went wrong.
Yeah.
Ran really smoothly.
It was exactly like I thought it would be.
All brilliant for someone's state of mind. This is all...
It was really, you can imagine, can't you? And, yeah, at one point in the show, I just went over to Ed. I tapped him on the shoulder and said, I'm off, mate. I'll see you later. And he turned around and went, if you do, you'll probably live the rest of your life regretting it. I'm like, good point.
In terms of how Radiohead as a group work, someone I think was asking you about this idea of a band democracy, and you said...
I'm America.
Radiohead's like the United Nations.
Yeah.
I'm America, which has obviously got maybe overtones you don't really want.
Yeah.
They've got worse.
And no, it wouldn't work anyway.
Exactly.
I'm is that America? Confused? Angry? Ineffective?
Is that still the case?
I'm less of a nightmare, usually.
Why is that?
I just got bored of it. I decided I needed to enjoy my work before it killed me, you know? And I over the years, I felt like, okay, I guess if I'm honest with myself, I felt that I've wanted to... it was like an insatiable hunger to find something, and then realising, actually, it's not about that. It's about the process.
Yeah.
You know, it's about feeling free to enjoy the process of writing and recording a piece of music. That's it. That's all it's about forever. Amen. You know, particular examples stick in my mind. Like, Everything's Right Place, which was one of those ones. We went round and round and round in circles until eventually I was ushered off into a room and said, just put on the synth and sing on top. Oh, yeah, okay. And then something like Daydreaming, where I didn't have a clue how the hell we were going to get that together, and made myself absent again and came back, and Nigel and Johnny just created the bare bones of it from... you know, really, really fast, and it just came together really quickly. And then he was talking to me about cellos, detuned cellos, following my voice grunting, and I'm like, yeah, this is what I'm talking about. So, it, to me, you know, if anything's changed, it's just now I look forward to those moments where you feel like the door's still open and the possibilities are still there to do something you don't expect.
How is it dealing with that level of scrutiny, though?
Because I don't feel it at all.
I mean...
I think it's funny. It's a joke. All I care about is our scrutiny, if that's what you mean. I mean, nothing else is relevant at all. I stopped reading what people think about our records long time. I went through all that.
Yeah?
Yeah, after OK Computer. Like I said, I was catatonic, and I was trying to work a lot on my own when we were having a break, and... it was weird, man. Like, every time I picked up a microphone, a monologue would start in my head, and I'd start pulling apart whatever I was doing before I even done it, you know? And it was about that. It was about... I'd sort of got into a habit of having to have conversations about our work and listening to what people said and their interpretations of my lyrics and all this stuff. And it eventually, like, okay... that's enough now. But it took me a long time to sort of shake it out of my head. You know, a really long time. Like, most of 1999 and 2000, I was really struggling to get free of that sort of corrosive analysis. It was like, a minute, really? You know, luckily at the time I was trying to learn to surf. That kind of helped because I'd come out of the water just relieved I hadn't killed myself or drowned. Never put it in perspective.
Also, this idea of, like, oh, the incredibly sort of tortuous and difficult process. It's like, but if it wasn't, if you weren't getting something from it, you'd stop doing it.
Yes,
you would all stop doing it if it was as.
Well, that really came into focus when, you know, when we suddenly all had families and kids, and you got to, like, if you're going to go and choose to do this, you're going to go and sacrifice the time. You should be at home watching your kids grow up to go and do this stuff. You better enjoy it, otherwise you're just going to kill yourself and everything around you. Mm. So for a while, obviously, me being me, I'm like, oh, you've lost your edge, mate. But that edge of which I was speaking was the thing that was stopping me working.
Yeah.
So, goodbye.
We should ask you to pick an Aphex Twin track, because an artist that's... is very important to you.
Huh. It's that one he did with Square Pusher. It absolutely blew my mind when I first heard it. John Peel played it. And I had to stop the car. I've never done that in my life. I had to just stop the car.
Really?
I was in shock. It's kind of like this weird mutant drummer bass tune. That there's something in that, this sort of casual collaboration where obviously neither of them really gave a rat's ass. They were just doing what they were doing, you know. But something happens in the middle of what they're programming together or through together, something happens and makes you go, oh my God.
When did you first get politicised?
I would say I'm one of Thatcher's children. So, boom. You know, we grew up under the bomb. We still had that concept. And then going to college, getting sort of sucked into student politics. On one side, it really motivated me because I used to love debating. I still do. But at the same time, you see how the left goes left, the right goes right. And you're like, oh, really? Okay. You realise how dry it is. The student politics has sort of kind of put me off it for life, in a weird way, because you kind of see the sort of people it attracts and makes you despair. But at the same time, it's a love-hate relationship, because I feel like I've never really been able to just walk away. A lot of times I wish I could have walked away, but I think ultimately it's always been there, and our generation especially grew up with it, and it was an incredibly important part of what happened in music. It's very odd that we've just got a little Tippex thing and just, oh yeah, we don't need to worry about that bit.
First track, the first single off Moonshaped Pool, Burn the Witch, seems to be implicitly about people looking for scapegoats, political scapegoats, people.
It was originally written about the tabloid witch hunts of the paedophiles long time ago. The original impetus was reading some reports about, I mean, they still do it now. It's what they're good at. When whatever newspaper it was started the witch hunts and started naming where these people lived and all that stuff. But then that was a long time ago. It got shelved and then it seemed to have its time.
Since you started the tour, you've been playing pretty much all of that album. Do you feel the songs changing and the songs evolving?
Yeah, I mean, the Numbers is the one I really enjoy, and Identikit in a different way. But the Numbers is, it has like this really cool swing about it. But then these things always happen, you know. The songs change. It's part of what it is like.
Mentioning the Numbers, that seems to be the other one of the other recurring passions of yours. Environmentalism, I don't know if passion is the right word.
The thing rattling around in my mind was, is it still possible to write a political song? Is it still possible to bring these subjects up and try and get some, any kind of semblance of emotion out of the corpse, you know, of these issues in a piece of music? I was listening to this Adam Curtis podcast that Mr. Buxton just did, where he's talking about the fact that as soon as someone realises, oh, this documentary is about the environment, or as soon as someone realises, oh, well, this book is about politics, people just switch off. Mm-hmm. They go, oh, right, I'll put that in that box over there because that doesn't mean anything to me. And that was the thing that was going around my head. Why is that? Why is it that I'm not allowed to mention these things? Why is it that if I sing A River Running Dry, you know, that or The System Is a Lie, the painful cliche, but it's also true. So what am I supposed to do? How else are you supposed to say the system is a lie? Why bother? Why bother hiding it? It's a lie. That's it. So it was like this weird fight with myself of like, can I get away with this? Is this the right thing to do? Or shall I write another lovey-dovey song about nothing in particular? Is that what the world needs? Or has someone else got that covered? I think so. It holds us like a phantom. The touch is like a breeze. Shines us understanding. See the moon smiling. Open all the channels, ready to receive. Swing out at the mercy. Shimmers and spells. Shimmers and spells.
Are you an optimist? Are you quite positive?
Yeah. That song is One Day at a Time.
Hmm.
You know, One Day at a Time, mate. You will be impeached shortly, mate. You're not a leader, love. And people are going to see it very soon, love. You know, one day at a time. You can't sustain this. It's not going to work. Good luck. One day at a time. We ain't stupid.
When I interviewed Phil, he said that normally at the end of a record, it feels like the last record. Until then, it's just not the last record anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I hope there's this desire to keep working as Radiohead.
Oh, yeah, but I just don't know. Like usual, I don't really know the way in yet.
What do you mean?
Well, usually something happens. You find a key idea, which is the thing that opens it up, and everyone goes, oh, okay. But I think at the moment, I guess because I'm stuck in, I'm obsessing about everything else I'm doing. I think once that's finished, there will be like a collection of ideas which will give us the chance to get together, you know. And that's kind of how it works.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, we're not living on a bus together. So the way that we find connections with each other is through something that's being created or half created. I just want it to carry on being a process everyone enjoys. That's all I care about. And something that's still a surprise.
What's the last song we should play?
I've been umming and ahhing. It's either something from that new Clark record or Gil Scott-Heron from 125 and Lennox, that record. In fact, probably that one. Even though the Clark record's really good, so check that out as well. His version of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which is on that record, is just him and these percussionists. And most of the whole record is just him and his poems. It's very, very, very angry record, but amazing, amazing. And this version of Revolution Will Not Be Televised, it stops me in my tracks every time I hear it.
Then that's what we'll finish on.
Yeah.
Good to speak to you. Thank you.
Nice one. Thanks very much.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lifes of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm women liberationists and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, or Engelbert Humperdinck. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be televised. Not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
This is BBC Radio 6666 Music.